Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
In deciding where to put our career efforts, most of us like to get on the ground floor of the next big thing. But which of those are headed to the penthouse, which to the basement? My guest this morning on Work with Marty Nemko could be described as a techno-optimist. He writes, "Future people will envy us, wishing they could have witnessed the birth we saw. It was in these years that humans began animating inert objects with tiny bits of intelligence, weaving them into a cloud of machine intelligences, and then linking billions of their own minds into this single supermind. The hope is that the inevitable technological progress is going to be a net good. It's going to cure cancer, solve environmental problems, eliminate soul-sucking repetitive work, create the next Google, Wikipedia, iPhone. But there are techno-pessimists, like Oxford's Nick Bostrom, who fear that our technocentric world makes us, for example, too vulnerable to a lone wolf hacker who could bring the electronic grid or the banking system, and in turn the world, to a halt. Or even, the technology will lead to self-teaching machines that are smart enough to control humans, maybe even to Armageddon, and thus, we should proceed with the precautionary principle in mind that it's better to avoid creating new technologies unless the risks are clearly small." With me to address the issues in the present and future of technology is a guy in a good position to point us to ground floor technologies likely to end up in the penthouse, as well as to edify us about likely futures we're likely to face or embrace. Kevin Kelly was editor of the Whole Earth Review. He co-founded Wired magazine and was its executive editor for its first 7 years, and currently, I love the title, is Senior Maverick there. And he's written a new bestseller. The book best-selling is always tossed around, but his is actually a bestseller. I looked on Amazon. It is best-selling. It's called The Inevitable, The 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Doesn't mean much for me to say I found the book inspiring and thought-provoking, although it's true. I actually read it cover to cover. I got it just yesterday, and I read it, found myself compelled to read it cover to cover, even reread a chapter. But former New York Times tech guru, now he's the equivalent at Yahoo, David Pogue, said of Kevin Kelly and the book, quote, "Anyone can claim to be a prophet, a fortune teller, futurist, and plenty of people do. What makes Kevin Kelly different is that he's right." This book is like, this is continuing to quote, "This book is like having a crystal ball, only without the risk of shattering." Kevin Kelly, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, it's my privilege and pleasure.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm a worrywart by nature, and so a lot of my, you know, this show's got to focus on work, and I'm also a worrywart by nature, so a lot of my questions are going to be worries about the implications for human beings' work in the new techno future that I really believe you very accurately, at least it passes my common sense test, so well predict. So I worry about technology replacing lots of jobs, from clerk to physician, and offshoring doing a lot of the replacement of many of the other jobs, except for crap jobs like janitor. You think it's going to be like the car replacing the buggy and thereby creating more jobs? Or is it going to be different this time, if only, as Jaron Lanier, who appeared on this show, said, because so many new products are software, which requires only a few smart people to make the first copy and then not a single person to create a zillion more. What is your real feelings about this?
I am optimistic. Although I have to say that there will probably be a period where there will be some friction and conflict, and I think we're seeing that already with the rise of Trump, which I think is tapping into a frustration that really has nothing to do with China or Mexico. It has to do with the fact that automation is taking away very many traditional jobs. There will be more of that, but I do think in the short term there will still be a net gain of new jobs that the technology allows us to make.
Paint a picture for me about how I can't even envision the scenario of a new sort of cohort, a large enough cohort of new jobs, other than kind of low-level service jobs, helping new moms with their babies and helping kids with their homework and teaching people technology and helping old people age in place. Beyond those relatively low-pay jobs, which even those are not going to be enough of them, paint the picture of how you could picture there being large numbers of decent jobs in this new technocentric world.
Well, first of all, there's a couple of things about the low-paying jobs. I don't know if you've had to do any plumbing recently, but I was paying more for my plumber than I was professional services like getting a website developed.
But those won't
burn
you.
Hourly charge was greater. So what happens is that as these jobs become scarcer, they actually increase in price. So there is one dynamic going on.
Wait, that's not true. It's the other way around. If there's going to be X number of plumber jobs, but there's going to be a hell of a lot more people wanting work, that's going to drive the average salary down, no?
If people want to become plumbers. And so, by the way, it takes quite a bit of skill to be a good plumber.
Right.
Actually, my plumber came recently, and I was astounded because, in fact, he also had an iPad and his cell phone going while he was working, because he was looking up stuff, you know, the user manual. I mean, it was actually a very sophisticated work environment for him. He's under the sink, and he's got his iPad down there.
Right.
I was like, wow, this is the future. And he was charging, I don't know, like $200 an hour. It was
great.
Amazing.
You know, your point is well taken. You say
I think. There are a lot of new jobs that we will create that will be based around the fact that what humans are really good at is wasting time, basically. If you have a job that can be specified in terms of its efficiency or productivity, then that's a job that's going to go to the bots in some capacity, whether it's white collar or blue collar. But a lot of what humans are really good at is sort of like trying things, exploring things, working with people. All these things, including interpersonal relationships, these are not very efficient. These are things you can't really wring out of productivity. And those are the kinds of things that we like, as humans, that we're going to gravitate to and that we find special. You know, the only thing increasing in price over the long term, right now, historically, you take a 100-year trend for anything we can imagine that we manufacture or make, almost everything is headed down, cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. The one things that are rising in real dollars are things that are based around experiences, like the kinds of things you just mentioned, nursing care, concerts, music concerts, things where there are human experiences and interpersonal relationships and there's exploration. Those are the only things increasing in price. So that suggests that's where our money is going to go. That suggests that's where the livelihoods will be.
Well, that takes me to my next worry. You use the term exploration. You even talk about the plumber who has to be very skilled and very smart in diagnosis or whatever. But we don't like to say the world is, but by definition, half the world is below average in intelligence, in drive, in emotional togetherness, in everything. And
No. Actually, I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Half the world is below average in one of those dimensions, but we are not one-dimensional beings. This is one of the mistakes, actually, of a lot of the AI people as well as normal people. Intelligence is not a single vector. It's not a single dimension. Our intelligences are a suite of hundreds of different types of thinking, including emotional intelligence, including social intelligence. And whereas nobody is 100% in everything, and some people are very high in math, they can be very low in other things. And everybody, I believe, has a certain strength in the mixture. And so everybody is sort of better than somebody in overall in something. And so I reject the idea that there are people who are below average in everything. That is just... Because the thing is the average is you're averaging 100 things. It's not a single dimension.
I got to push back.
And I really object to the idea of reducing people to a single dimension.
And I got to really push back. I'm not reducing them to a single dimension, but it is absolutely a falsity that people – no one's made the argument, that was a straw man, that everybody is below average in everything. But really, this thing we call intelligence, the ability to learn, to reason, to abstract, is highly correlated, whether it be intellectual abstract or, quote, social intelligence. The reality is there are going to be, in a world of 7.3 billion people, there are going to be billions of people who really, whose reasoning skills, whether it be in a social context or an abstract context, is going to be something that is not going to be able to be explored. These jobs you're talking about, exploratory and being, have this great social intelligence, there, you know, we can quibble about the number, but the reality is there's going to be a hell of a lot of people who are going to be left behind, and they're human beings entitled to a reasonable quality of life. And I worry that we can't just broad brush say, well, everybody's the best at something, or everybody's even above average in something, because anybody who spent a lot of time in with populations not like that, and I have spent a ton, could not make that assertion. I want to give you the last word on that before we go on.
No, actually, I agree. I spent a lot of time with people around the world who are very disadvantaged, who are poor, and I would reject that. I would say they are absolutely above average in something, every one of them.
Okay.
They have some special ability, some special charm, some special way. Every single one of the persons that I ever met in my entire life are like that, and I reject the idea that they are below average.
Okay, let's turn to your book. It is impossible to reduce your rich book to a soundbite, but if I had to, it would be that the future is tracking, parsing, and cognifying zillabytes of data to empower people. You want to disagree with that? You want to explain that? What's your thoughts? What do you want to do?
So I think where we're headed to is a world in which we're doing something really remarkable we've never done before, which is we had a world, the Industrial Revolution, it was made by artificial power. We harnessed the, you know, when you drive down the road in your car, you have 250 horses working for you. And we distributed that in a grid, and we made this artificial power available to anybody to just plug it into the wall. And now we're going to do the same thing with the other thing that we identify ourselves with, which is this suite of emotional intelligences and, you know, reasoning. And then we're going to have these artificial smartness as well that is going to really make another second industrial revolution in terms of the ability anybody can plug into wall and buy that and to do something with that. And just as any person alive today almost that lives in a city can purchase artificial power, now we can purchase artificial smartness. And
absolutely,
I think we can then use that to do whatever we want to do, even if you're not smart. And that is going to be something that we can do. 100 years ago, they had VPs of electricity, and that was a job in a lot of companies, VP of electricity, because electricity was this really complicated, esoteric thing. Of course, now we don't even think about it because it's invisible. And that's going to be the same thing with AI, is we have VPs of AI now, but we soon won't, because anybody will be able to use it.
That makes perfect sense, and it's also going to have impact on jobs. I mean, artificial intelligence has been touted since the 60s, when there was this piece of software called Eliza, and it was tried to be a virtual psychotherapist. And today, we've got AI highly visible in our smartphones, you know, with the voice recognition in Siri and the auto adjustments in the point-and-shoot camera that's in there, and in the recommendation engines we use, like an Amazon or Netflix or Spotify, and most sophisticated of all, Google, which shepherds you to web pages and products based on your buying history. Now, you're saying that in your book, you say that Google's main product in a decade isn't going to be search, but AI. But isn't that going to kill jobs in the professions? I mean, after all, an AI-powered doctor or accountant or even lawyer at some point is going to be more accurate and cheaper than a human one.
Yeah, I think jobs are mostly the bundles of tasks. And so a lot of the tasks that we do will go to AIs. And by the way, we will work with them. You will be paid by how well you work with them, because the smartest dietitian in medicine right now is not an AI like Watson, and it's not a doctor. It's a team of AI and doctors, just as the best chess champion in the entire planet is not an AI, even though it beat a human. It's not a human. It's a team of AI and humans. So we're going to work together with these AIs, and many of the jobs will entail working with AIs for some of the roles. And so we have a great difficulty right now imagining what those roles would be. But imagine if we'd gone back 150 years in America, where 70% of the people in this country were farmers, and you brought them pink slips, and you said, hey, basically we're down to less than 1% of farmers. All of you are going to lose your jobs. And the farmers would say, what are we going to do? and you say, oh, you're going to be a web designer. You're going to be a yoga teacher. You're going to be a mortgage broker. And they would look at you as like, that's impossible. What are those things? I can't even imagine what they are. And they were all generated, in some senses, by our inventions. So our inventions create new needs that we didn't even know we had. So there'll be all kinds of things revolving around the fact that half of the people who drive trucks will lose those jobs in 20 years, but there will be this infinite number of new kinds of things, even revolving around transportation, even revolving around trucks, in optimizing the route, in keeping the trucks going, in repairing the you know, whatever it is, the location device. There is so many new jobs just going to be built around transportation, the fact that we bring AI to it. They all seem strange to us now. We have a very difficult time to imagine them, but they will be there because that is what technology does.
And that, you are supporting my very concern. Every one of the jobs you describe is not going to require ability to be nice or whatever. The ability to help AI do its thing, the ability to interpret, all of those are highly skilled jobs. In the end, I worry about I'm concerned about all of humankind. How many people I know who use in the 18th century, 19th century were able to farm because it didn't require a lot of brain power, or in the industrial era where it was repetitive work on the assembly line, but in an era where so much is software centric, I'm worried, and brain power really is. Really, that raw brain power. You don't need to be a genius. I mean,
have you ever done farming? There is an incredible amount of brain power necessary to beat nature. It is a very difficult thing to do on a sustainable basis where every year you're growing enough food for your family, whatever. You must have never farmed, because this is a very intellectual thing to do.
As it's funny that you mention that. I'm a professional rose breeder, and I have harmed 10,000 roses. And
people don't realize.
No, it's pretty mechanical,
the amount,
dude.
Of smartness that you're trying. You're kind of basically trying to outsmart nature, is really tough.
You need a few smart people. Most farmers
requires a lot of skill to do that well.
Most farmers, in the end, there's going to be the professor of agriculture, but he's going to tell you pretty much cookbook. You need to fertilize this frequency, and here is this meter, and it says here's when the soil's too dry, and this is how much water you've got to set the automated timer to. Here is where you can taste it and see if it's ready to harvest. There is going to be the geniuses at the top of any field, but the millions of farmers anyway, I think we're beating a dead horse. Let's go to something else here. I want to take another liberal side of the argument. You talk about the sharing economy. You call it digital socialism, and you predict that it's even going to extend to artificial intelligence. You wrote that AI's brains are going to be crowdsourced. Do you worry that the big corporations then are going to get so much of our data for free, and by monitoring our internet activity, everything from how many paces we make when we're using our Fitbits to the bio-monitoring to our buying preferences on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Vine, and whatever, and they're going to make all the profits. Isn't that going to exacerbate the gap between rich and poor?
I think, yes. I think there is a widening difference between, I would say, the rich and the very, very rich. I think the general trend right now, worldwide, if we're speaking globally, is we're still moving people into the middle class. So we're still moving billions of people from poverty into the middle class. Now, once they get into the middle class, the super rich and the extremely rich are getting much, much richer. But in a kind of a sense, that's not the main story going on. Even the middle class are rising in their prosperity overall in most countries around the world, outside of the U.S. And so, I would expect that will continue. That in I don't know, whatever figure you want to say, in 20 years, the average living standard will be higher for most people in the world, and that's going to be due to the inventions that were inventing. The super rich will be even richer. So in that sense, that gap is widening. And I think what we want to do is to work as best as we can to level that. I'm not sure that the corporation itself is the culprit in this, because the thing about these temporary monopolies that the giants have, Amazon,
Google,
is that they're short-lived. They will have, in any network, you have these very large winners that take all, but they don't last very long because the next platform comes along and it completely overturns the dominance. So Google is basically at its peak right now, and someone who figures out how to do AI 10 times, 100 times better than Google, that doesn't rely on the same large data set, is going to displace Google in that next round. So I think the temporary monopolies are actually very useful to everybody. They bring the cost down. They're not like the industrial monopolies where the cost went up to the consumers. And so I think that these are good. This is a good price to pay.
I got to say, again, you know, I found myself thinking I was going to agree with most of what you're going to say, and I'm finding myself disagreeing with almost everything. I don't know anything about the world, but I know a lot about the United States employment situation. The middle class is getting hollowed out. The actual average income in real dollars of the middle class is declining, and the number of people in the middle class is declining. There are many more people. While the unemployment rate is low, the number of people with part-time crappy temp jobs paying crap with little benefits is increasing. The middle class is, there's a reason the term the hollowing out of the middle class has almost become cliche at this point. No one can really say that in the United States that the middle class is doing better. That's just not real.
Except for the United States. I'm talking about worldwide. I'm giving a global view.
All right. Okay.
I'm giving the global view, which is what you were kind of talking about. And so the global view is, and also I think that this again, I will go back to what I said. I think there is a temporary time right now where there is going to be conflict, and this is one of the results of this hollowing out. But I don't think in 20 years this will be erased.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm having more of a debate than I thought I'd be having with the author of a book I absolutely love, because I think he's right about the... And I'm going to try to essentialize it. The name of the book is The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. The notion is that there's going to be this confluence of a number of factors. The ability to have all of this data on our phones in more simulation environments, in more better filtered ways to be able to parse out what you need, to combine different technologies. I think the power of big data is going to reduce our chance of getting cancer. It could maybe even keep our that horrific shooting in the LBGT bar, the terrorist guy, lone wolf terrorist. You in your own book, you talked about in Minority Report, talked about a movie in which they were able to predict whether a person's going to commit a crime before and arrest him. Is that do you think that would prevent things like that horrific shooting that happened yesterday in Orlando? And you think it's bad?
Well, only if we had an Orwellian society.
Right.
I mean, I worked on this movie with Spielberg on Minority Report, where he had pre-crime, which I thought at the time was kind of like a completely ridiculous idea that you could actually imagine where the crime was going to happen. But what's happening right now, where we're headed to the next couple of years, is we're tracking everything,
right.
And there will be more tracking
right.
in our lives in 20 years from now. And by the way, if you get into virtual reality, those worlds are totally tracked. Everything you do is trackable. It's not being tracked right now, but it is trackable in a much easier way.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having a society where you are actually tracking all the things and then trying to predict crime is technically possible, but it's not necessarily a society that I want to live in.
Right. That's the trade-off.
So what I'm suggesting is something called covalence, which is to a way of dealing with this inevitable more tracking. Covalence is not inevitable. We have a choice, and I'm hoping we choose that, which is that we watch the watchers. Yeah, the police are filming everything, but we're filming the police. And we have access to what the police films, and we know what happens to the information we have. They can hold them accountable, and we get some benefit for
yep.
this. So this idea of bringing symmetry back into the tracking,
mm-hmm.
so it's not just one-sided, I think is really the only way I can imagine that we can make this world of increased tracking civilized.
And there I agree with you. And so some of that is a matter of opt-in. Where you're really clear about opting in terms of all that
right.
tracking,
that's part of it. But I think there's also holding things holding people yep. accountable, being able to correct the information that they have, knowing what it is that they have about you, and getting some direct benefits for what they
absolutely
know.
And that's what, I mean, the most obvious example of is the police body cams, where there's going to be this accountability, the public accountability of the police when they see. And I think everybody, liberals and conservatives, should embrace the body camera so that the reality is
right.
is seen. Yeah.
But the citizens need to have access to that, so they
yeah.
can't just film it and not have access.
I agree with you.
Yeah, and vice versa. And so we should be filming the police, too. And that's
agree.
The other thing.
Absolutely.
They have a perfect right to actually film the police, and they should have access to that, so on. That's covalence.
I want to be, again, in my obsession about balance, you talked about virtual reality. Instead of me talking about, oh, this is going to kill jobs, this is going to hurt this, this is going to hurt privacy, let's talk about one of your 12 mega trends that you speak about, technology certainly is virtual reality. You mentioned it just a moment ago. What's an impressive example of the current state of virtual reality?
Well, there's a secretive lab down in Florida that has devised a pretty good version where you wear transparent glasses and you see virtual things in your room or in your office that really feel to you as if they're really present. And so I've tried this out. It really does work. There's another version of virtual reality where you wear the closed goggles and you're in an entire new world.
Mm-hmm.
And that also works pretty good. But the most vivid experience I've had in trying all these things out in the last 5 months was a place called The Void, which is actually in Utah, I think Salt Lake City, and it's kind of like an arcade experience where they have a whole big room and you put on the goggles and gloves and a suit, a kind of like a vest, and you go in and there's a mix of the real world and the virtual world, and you're exploring things, roaming around, and you're moving, and you are completely transported in another way. And when things happen, you can fall two stories, and you don't really fall, but you feel like you fall. You can feel it in your chest. You see things. You can hold things. It is an amazing transformation, and I think that's one of the ways we're going to go. You know, people have them in their bedroom, but you'll pay $30 to go to your local VR theater and have that kind of experience that you can't have at home.
That makes, again, I'm delighted to be able to, that makes perfect sense. But what puzzles me is it would seem that VR should already be embedded in education. I mean, I teach in the medical school at UCSF.
I think it's going to transform education.
Exactly. Well, I teach in the medical school at UCSF, and, you know, medical students right now have to do it on cadavers and these really cheesy little, their lectures and whatever. It seems to me that there should be a virtual reality, like you said, you feel viscerally, where the medical student is practicing the surgery and you feel the way the skin of the patient feels when you press the scalpel in, or in a physics course, you're
absolutely
in a room with a bomb and you need to dismantle it. Why has why has that, even 2D simulations are rarely a part of online courses? Do you have any idea why true immersive simulations, which are just not that expensive to develop, why have they not become core to online courses?
I think it's a matter of technology. So I experienced virtual reality with Jerry Lanier, your previous guest, almost 25 years ago. He made a version that was really pretty good. Not that much different than we could get with the Oculus. What was the difference? In today's dollar, that would have cost $1 million to do. Mm. The reason why VR right now is on everybody's lips and so hot is because it's taking smartphone technology, the navigation, accelerometers, and to know where the phone is, and you transfer that to your head movement. The screens on the phone are now what you see inside. So now it's like a couple hundred dollars, and that has been the big advance in the last 2 or 3 years, and I think we're going to see all that kind of stuff happening in the next couple of years.
You bet. I mean, that's already in the 360 Kinect, the little Vive gaming console.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the founder of Magic Leap, that was doing the MR that I really liked, came from surgical robots. He was originally trying to do knee surgery and have that VR, not just for the student, but for the doctors who want to be able to go through and kind of see this virtual knee. So there's definitely that interest, and I think we're just at the cusp where this is going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
There you go. I think I'd like to give my listeners a chance to ask you a question or two. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Kevin Kelly. He was one of the co-founders of Wired magazine. He was the editor at the Whole Earth Catalog. He's now, I love it, Chief Maverick at Wired, and he's written a brand new book that truly is a bestseller, and I read cover to cover in a day. really fascinating, called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. You want to speak to him? This is your only shot. Phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You know, like I said, I'm a worrywart. Another of my worries is the demonetizing of work. How the hell are people going to make a living? You write that the sharing economy is only in its infancy. Wikipedia, Airbnb, Uber, which of course is dramatically lowering cab driver pay. And then you mention 99 Designs, which I've used myself, in which dozens of designers compete for a few $100 gig, and all but one of them gets no money. So there's no money to be a designer. And then movies and books are so easily pirated. Won't we soon reach the point when it's not worth making one of these wonderful movies we enjoy watching? And unless you're a celebrity, book writing's no longer a career. I'm a writer. I've wrote 8 books, but I've stopped writing them because so many of my copies are downloaded illegally that almost none are sold. After the research costs, I'd lose money for writing a book. Is the sharing economy...
I don't make money in the books. I make money in my talks, which can't be copied. Right. And I think that's generally what you see about authors, is that the books are copies which can be copied and pirated.
Right.
And so people really aren't making the money in the copies. They're making what I call generatives in my book, The Inevitable. I talk about these things that can't be copied very well, like immediacy, trust, personalization. And so the base copy is basically free, and you actually have to charge something that can't be copied very well, including your appearance, consultations, live performances, personalization, customization. These are all things that you're really charging for, and that's actually where the new economy is going.
And exactly, again, that's where people of Kevin Kelly's intelligence and fame and bona fides is going to do fine. But isn't that going to kill the film industry, the music industry, the career of writing, unless you are a Kevin Kelly or a celebrity or a Hillary Clinton who can command $1 million a speech?
No, I think, see people think of, there's Hollywood makes 1,200 hours of film or video a year. That's a drop in the bucket compared to all the video that's produced. Or all, you know, same thing about the books and words. Most of the film economy is not in these handcrafted, boutique, charismatic works that aren't really going to change very much. We'll still go out to these blockbuster things. The real action is in this lower, the large biomass of the whatever media you're talking about, and that's really what you want to look at, because that is where the action is. And the question is, well, how are people making money there? And in many cases, they're probably not making money
exactly
there. But they never have.
And that's a lot. But I'm saying, if the big blockbuster films are being pirated like crazy, why the hell are we going
to? We like to think of piracy as a tax for success. That's the best way to think of piracy. Is the most authors and artists are resigned to obscurity, and
poverty.
If you are successful, you will be pirated. But most people are not. They're not being blocked from success because of piracy.
Well, we'll see. Our phones all lit up really quick as soon as I got the phone number. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Kevin Kelly?
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing? For Kevin Kelly and for Marty Nemko, will VR be able to tell us what it will be like ahead of time to have President Hillary Clinton or President Trump in office?
You know, if I had that machine, I'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, well, I can predict. I think we're going to see there's going to be the first shutout in presidential election history. Trump ain't going to be president or anything close to it. And I think Hillary will be what, in this case, she will do what she says. She wants to have comprehensive immigration reform. She wants single-payer health care. She wants to redistribute from the rich to the poor. And that's what we're going to see. And
so you don't need a machine. You just need Marty.
There you go. Anyway, let's go to the phone. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's a question or comment for Kevin Kelly.
Hi, is it me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Great. My name is Fania Montalvo, and I'm a computer scientist.
Great.
And I'm working on AI, but I see a big problem in the current software, that there's like a jam, there's a problem, and that there's not enough abstraction. And it's very hard to get a big change in how software is done.
Explain what you mean. So, there's a lot of abstraction. I want to understand that better.
Well, I have a paper written about the singularity is here.
Yeah.
Meaning that The singularity of loss of control is here.
The singularity means when I need to explain what the singularity is. It's when computers are self-teaching and are able to actually be smarter than people, and it becomes uncontrollable because the computers are smarter.
Right.
Okay.
Well, there's two. I have a paper in which I pick those two things apart: the lack of control versus the computers are smart enough. I think we've reached the point where we no longer have control. From all the systems, not just computers, but computers with people, with corporations.
Yep. Kevin Kelly, I want Kevin to take this. What are your thoughts about the singularity?
Hold on. But the AI part is not smart enough yet.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
I'm
common.
I'm not a really big believer in the hard version, which is how you just explained it, Mari, which is this AI becoming smarter than humans, because I don't think there is such a thing as smarter than humans in all dimensions. And so I think that most of the AI that we're making is going to be non-human-like. That's the whole point. The reason why we want the AI driving our cars is because they don't drive like we do. They're not distracted. They're not worrying about whether they left the stove on and should they have majored in finance. They're engineered to be specialized. And what we're doing with AI is we're going to make a thousand different species of AI, thinking all of which are going to be different than us. That's the reason to do it. Some of them are already being used. Facebook is using AI to generate new algorithms in AI. That's already happening. But those think differently than we do. So I'm not a much of a believer in this idea that we have this singularity rapture of the nerds. That's going to happen. There's a lot of reasons other than that. So I'm not worried about the singularity coming over.
I need to push
it. I'm not worried about it either. What I'm worried about is that we don't have a good enough interfaces to interface with our AI so that they really understand us.
Yes, you're right. We don't.
And we need a big revolution.
Somebody who figures that out would make a lot of money.
That's what we're trying to figure out.
Well,
let me ask you an economic question, which is completely different. Which is the results of productivity have been flat to employees, but they've gone way up for those who control the technology.
Right.
For 40 years.
This is Jaron Lanier's basic argument.
How are we going to fix that?
So, I think productivity is for robots. I go back to what you're saying. Anybody will be able to buy AI. You'll be able to. Like, we can buy electricity and have automatic artificial power. We'll be able to buy AI, and you can do something with AI to make things more productive. Just like we turned over all the hard work and muscle of making things to machines, to the engines that we buy, to steam shovels. We're going to turn over a lot of that productivity kind of stuff to our other machines, these mind machines, the AIs, and they will help people who want to be more productive be more productive.
But right now it's just too centralized.
Yes.
Caller, I want to better understand two things. I want to understand that you say we need, and Kevin agreed, but I didn't understand it, and maybe the listeners didn't either. You say we need a better interface between the user and the AI. Explain what that is and why that's important.
Me?
Yes, you. Yeah, because you're the one who wrote the paper about it.
Every time I try to use my computer, I get into all kinds of problems.
Oh,
where
okay.
It runs away with its own idea of what it's doing. It doesn't let me talk.
Got it. Good. So better interfaces on your point. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it very much. Kevin, I want to, your optimism that you're going to use weak AI, which is that it's not going to be something that's going to be smarter than persons, is based on that same thing you said at the very beginning of the show, is that, you know, we've got all these different intelligences. But an AI doesn't need to be smarter at everything. It needs to just have stronger overall reasoning and abstraction power, in the same way as just recently a computer beat not only live chess player, but the best Go masters in the world.
Right.
So
that. Computer, of course, too, by the way.
Right.
So the computer, the AlphaGo that beat the chess master, the Go master, may not right now be able to beat the, or even play chess for that matter.
Right.
So here's the thing about, people think of humans as we have this sort of like this remarkable general purpose mind, intelligence. We don't. We don't have a general purpose mind. We have a very, very specific kind of mind.
That's where we've disagreed. We've said that before.
Hundreds of thousands of years to help us survive. Yep. And just as we had this Copernican revolution where we thought that we were at the center and all the planets revolved, the stars revolved around us, and then we discovered, oh, no, we're actually the third planet from the sun. And not only that, we're on out on the edge of some galaxy. Well, we have this idea that our minds are sort of this general purpose mind at the center, and then we have these satellite minds sort of around us, or that we can make our own general purpose intelligence sort of bigger. But in fact, our kind of thinking is way out on the edge of all possible types of minds. It's a very peculiar thing that is not at all general purpose, because there really isn't general purpose. It all depends on your purpose. And I think that we have a very mistaken idea of our own intelligence, given to the fact that we have such a small sample.
Yeah, that's where we, is where we start our disagreement, and we must continue, because while there have been many studies of factor analysis, this is what actually my PhD is in this field, that there is this, while there are these hypotheses about discrete social intelligence, emotional intelligence, musical intelligence, whatever. And of course, not everybody is excellent at everything. But there is this variable that cuts across all of them, called general intelligence, which does focus on, which at its foundation is probably about the neuronal density and what's in the neuronal soup and the neurotransmitters. But it really is the ability to remember, to abstract, to reason, to analyze and synthesize. And that's useful across a very wide range of things. And so to dismiss the power, it's called G, to dismiss the power of that is just simply unsupported by the facts. Let's turn to another topic, though, which is filtering, which is really interesting. One of your predicted trends is the increased power of filtering. And Google filters all of the world's websites to give you a result. And some, and I've experienced some of this, claim that the Google results are politically biased. Do you worry about having so much power for the control of people's thinking and judgments and voting patterns and everything else, so much power residing in one company's hands, whether it's Google or the next version of Google?
No, I think it goes back to what I was saying before. I think these are temporary things that are very susceptible to disruption. But I do think that there is a price that we are paying for all these free services, and we should make ourselves much more aware of what those prices are, and that there is a whole set of ethics that will come along with AI that we haven't really even talked about, that I think is actually really essential, which is how do we bias? Like, if you're driving down the car, the car is having a crash, the car is going to make decisions that a human couldn't about where it wants to go to. Should it bias the safety of the passenger versus the safety of the pedestrians? This is an ethical decision. Mm. It's being nudged in certain directions, and those nudges are actually pre-programmed. So therefore, we have to have this discussion about of the ability of these things to nudge us and the ethics of it, which we haven't begun to do, but I think we need to do.
Great point. And even something less dramatic than in those rare situations when you're trying to save when the decision is save a passenger's life versus the pedestrian's life versus the driver, simply at what speed do you set the autopilot? People are ever busier, they want to get where they want to go faster, but after a certain point there is an inflection point, and the faster you go, the increased chance of accidents and severe death increase. Somebody's going to make that decision as to where to set that speedometer.
Exactly right. And so who's having that conversation?
Right.
Is it you, the car manufacturer, the AI programmer, or society as a large? And those are the kinds of things I think are worth worrying about.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Kevin Kelly, the author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That'll Shape Our Future?
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, yeah. I'm intrigued by the discussion what you're both each bringing to the discussion. Marty, you, I believe, quite correctly point out that whatever the theoretical, there are people being unemployed.
Yes.
And the people who are employed in doing the same kind of thing, say the Uber driver versus the taxi cab driver, the Uber driver's getting ground down and earning less.
Yes.
To which the guest appears to me to be saying, hey, don't worry, the buggy whip the people who used to make the buggy whips, they got other jobs. What happened before is not necessarily what happens the next time it comes around.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, that the buggy whip manufacturer workers who then went to work in the automobile plants only got decent jobs when they unionized. And the only reason they were able to unionize was because we didn't have world trade to the extent where the General Motors could say in the 1930s, well, if you people, you union demand higher wages, we're going to shift our production to Mexico. It didn't exist. When the circumstances of the world change, the opportunities change. And I would appreciate it if the guest, instead of saying, well, look, the buggy whip makers got jobs, would deal with the realities of world trade as it bears upon the issue that you raised of whatever he may say, people are losing their jobs.
Your thoughts, Kevin?
Yeah, so I think the evidence is very clear that trade, international trade, increases the prosperity of people on average. There will be specific jobs that are lost. We can't help that, but on average, trade has increased prosperity, and so I don't see. I mean, I don't know if this caller is kind of arguing against that we should close down global trade.
I'm arguing that we should look at the facts as they actually exist, rather than the theoretical.
Exactly. Right.
Anyway,
so
thank you very much.
Show that international trade increases prosperity.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call. That is, you know, I've always found it interesting, and I'm sympathetic with a lot of what the caller said, but, you know, I have as much solidarity with a human being in Zambia as I do with somebody in Fresno.
Exactly right.
And
I
so
mean, look,
if...
Look what's happened to China. We rail against them, but in fact, we had there's more people moved into the middle class greater than the population of this country as a whole. That's really good.
Yeah, and I think about the fact that if somebody in Fresno loses his or her job, he or she is going to have X decrement to their quality of life. Whereas if that job then goes to somebody in Azerbaijan, or in any developing nation, that person's quality of life increment is so great that the net benefit to the world is a net positive in terms of quality of life.
Right, and in fact, the person who lost a job in Fresno probably has a greater opportunity to find another job than the person in China or Zimbabwe who did not have a job at
all. Okay, let's turn to something that's less controversial but just as interesting. You're aware, you've spent your life around a lot of venture capital folks, and you're aware of a lot of venture capital investments in technology. So what is one or two that you find particularly intriguing?
One or two venture capitalists?
Well, no, not capitalists. A venture cap, something that was funded in that venture capital or angel space that, you know, you just think, oh, that's really cool. I wish I would have invested in that instead of Andreessen's, venture firm.
I'm real confused by your question.
A specific project.
I wish I had invested, or you mean something that's happening right now that seems like it's a good thing?
Yeah, something that they've invested in that you say, oh, that's really cool. I wish I'm investing in that now. Something current.
Oh, I see. No. You know, it's funny because I don't do any of that kind of stuff, and I don't look at it, and in some senses I don't really care about that too much.
All right.
I find it's a little bit more of there's probably a little more gambling going on there than I'm comfortable with.
Okay.
I'm interested in the long-term trends, which I think are inevitable. However, the specifics, the actual specific products or companies, I think are really inherently unpredictable. And I think while the internet was inevitable, you know, Twitter is not. It's completely, you know, the telephone was inevitable. But, you know, the iPhone was not. So I think, for me, it's a little bit more of a kind of a gambling, I think, in trying to pick the winners that way. I'm interested in sort of these long-term forces that lean in a certain direction, kind of like Moore's Law or something. And I think those are much more trustworthy for me. So I actually am not very good at those kinds of...
Fair enough. That'd be a reasonable answer. So is that part of why you're involved in this thing called the 10,000-year clock?
Right. So we have this foundation called the Long Now Foundation, which is encouraging long-term views, not just the next quarter, not just even next year, but how about the 20 years, 50 years, 1,000 years, trying to think about working on something that may take more than our own lifetimes to finish, to do something really big. Where you're going to go to Mars. Okay, you may not get to Mars before you die, but other people will based on what you've done. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to do is to shift people's attention and say, you know, we can think generationally. We can take a long-term view, and we're building this crazy clock inside a mountain, inside West Texas, that's going to tick for 10,000 years by itself. And the purpose of the clock is to prompt people to think about what you could do if you had, you know, if you're thinking in terms of 10,000 years.
Okay, so but let's you know, my heart in, you know, we, as the previous caller says, I worry about human beings not finding good work. So it's great to have the long vision, the cosmic vision about what's going to be good for the world today, what's going to be good for the world 10,000 years from now. But in the end, this show is about work. What is Kevin Kelly's calm, wise man's advice? You're not a kid anymore. To young people who are, or middle-aged people who are trying to leverage the trends, the trajectories of technology to create good work for them if they're not a super PhD from MIT or Caltech.
Yeah.
What's your advice
to
those folks?
My advice is pretty standard, and it applies, again, to whatever you're, wherever you are, whatever country you're in, which is master something. Master something, and through that mastery, then go find your passion. Bring your passion with it. So select something and decide that you're going to become, devote the 10,000 hours that you need to become world class in it. Just, and that's deliberate use where you're actually trying to get better every day. So you're trying something. You're not being efficient all the time. You're trying something new, which will fail, which is inherently inefficient, which is not what robots do very well. Find something, whatever it is, and become master of. Try and become the best that you can wherever it is, and you'll move over time. What that is will change as you acquire mastery. It'll shift over time, so you won't end up where you started, and hopefully where you end up is you'll have passion about that thing.
I love that, and I agree, because it's contra to the standard. It's the reverse order. Choose something. It doesn't. You're not going to get passionate about it until you're great at it.
Right.
Choose something first. Put the 10,000 hours in, then you will become passionate because you're the go-to guy or go-to gal.
Right.
There, I agree with you 10,000%.
You will shift as you go along. You won't end up where you started. Nobody
right. Does. It's like being dropped on a helicopter at the top of a mountain. You can't just stay on the top of the mountain. You look down the various paths briefly, and then you pick one. And then you know what happens? You go down the path, and you find a side path that you couldn't have seen from the top.
Exactly.
Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Kevin Kelly, the author of The Inevitable. What's your question or comment for him?
I work in fashion. Well, I work in costumes. And so I read a lot about global marketing and clothing and waste and environmental degradation. And a broker in India made the comment that this is an industry that follows human misery. So I take exception to the idea that globalization is always improves conditions for people all over the world.
Kevin?
So,
thank you for the call, by the way. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that the data and evidence shows that it is. I think that, not to say that there isn't the strange attractors at which, you know, the lowest paid, the clothes are always going to try to go to the lowest paid place in the world, and those working conditions are terrible. However, the whole point of that, having people do that, is we can improve them. We can work with them to try to improve those conditions. And I think that's much better attempt than to not have them doing anything at all.
Okay, let's turn. We were just about out of time, so I always like to end these interviews, especially with guests whom I like, even though I disagree with you some things, I certainly agree with you on some others. On a very more personal note, you're not a kid anymore, and you're a human being, and you are moving through this ever-accelerating pace of change when you're a guy who's not a kid anymore and it's perceived as a young person's game. I'm interested in Kevin Kelly, the human being, right now. What is next, really, for Kevin Kelly, the professional and the human being?
Yes, yeah, so I have the privilege of traveling around the world, spending a lot of time in the developing world, very remote places, and and plenty of big cities in the developing world as well. And I think that there are I think nationalism is a disease, and I think that we have world problems from immigration to the economy to climate change, and I think that we need to have a world government. And I have no idea what that means. I don't know how you have a democratically elected $7 billion thing. I don't know how that works.
Yep.
None of my people on the friends on the left like it. Nobody on the right likes it. Nobody
likes it.
We need it. And so this is what I'm interested in.
Absolutely, because all this internecine warfare is foolish because everything is interdependent.
Exactly.
And there's, you know, perfect is the enemy of the good. So what you're going to have, you have one world government. There's going to eventually be upstart little either nation states or individual insurrectionists or terrorists or whatever. So the perfect is the enemy of the good. But you don't stop going for what obviously makes sense, which is, you know, a world government with, you know, the synergies.
World police force. I mean, like the U.S. should not be the world cop. I'm sorry.
Yep. Anyway, on that point of agreement, it is a pleasure. Thank you very much, Kevin, for being my guest on Work With Marty Nemco. The book, and I swear to you, dear listeners, you know, I get 200, 300 books a year. Most of them I glance at for a moment, some I skim. This I read cover to cover because it was compelling, and I didn't need
to. Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I love disagreeing with you.
Yeah, it was real fun. I enjoyed it very much, Kevin. I wish you all the best. A big metaphorical hug across the airways.
Okay, well, thank you.
Take care. The book, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. I have a couple minutes left. I never like to waste a moment. I have only given one commencement address in my life. This is commencement your time. And it was at Columbia College in Missouri. And maybe because it was my first, it was fairly conventional. On reflection, I wish I had been brave enough to give the following advice. The graduates have heard, they've heard plenty of conventional exhortations, but maybe not these. Luck matters more than we want to admit. Your entire life is dramatically affected by the luck of whom you're born to. If you're born to a brilliant, well-adjusted, financially secure parent in the U.S., your chance of health and wealth and great jobs and other success are far greater than if you're born to a low-intelligence, violent parent, for example, in war-torn Syria. But even much later in life, luck can trump smarts and effort. Personal example, I tried to get course credit for some off-campus work I had done, and the professor asked me, well, what did I learn there? And I said, even eminent people make mistakes. For some reason, just that one little phrase was enough for him to give me 2 semesters of A, and that's all I needed to graduate. Then when I applied to graduate school, and I was rejected from most of them because I was just an okay student from a only moderately selective college, prestigious Berkeley gave me a free ride in its doctoral program because it counted only my final year's undergraduate grades, which were all A's, merely because that professor was overimpressed by my cliched one-liner. Luck matters. Be humble enough to realize it, and humility not only is appropriate, it's going to make you better liked. Next principle, the non-intellectual is important, even to intellectuals. Here's another UC Berkeley admissions example. This one's my wife's. When I was a grad student, a professor invited the students and their significant other to a party. And here, you know, in the Bay Area, the norms bring a bottle of wine. But for some reason, my wife decided to bring a pie plate. My professor somehow was, that professor was touched by that, which triggered a very pleasant conversation between them. And although they didn't talk about anything intellectual, she invited my wife to apply to Berkeley's grad school. And like me, on her grade, she couldn't have gotten into Berkeley, but yet she's gone on to get her PhD from there. Now she's a nationally prominent school superintendent. And finally, just pick a career already. We tend to wait for the career. Fact is, for most people, most careers are pretty much interchangeable. Your contentment and success in it are going to depend far more on whether you work hard at it, and yeah, on luck, than on which career. And by choosing now, rather than waiting for your eureka moment, you can start getting expert in making connections in your field. If you just wait, like, for example, traveling or taking an interim job like barista, you probably won't have gotten clear on your career in years later. You're only going to be poorer and less accomplished than you could have been. So choose your career now, or at least allow yourself only a few more weeks of exploration. Then focus on getting the best training, especially working at the elbow of an ethical master, and then adapting to the career to suit your strengths. So, in conclusion, I'll stop there because I'm looking at the clock and we are out of time. But those are some of the things I would say, especially career-related, to those who were graduating if I had the privilege of giving a commencement speech. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and my wife, the aforementioned Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate the best solutions to your call-in questions and emailed career questions. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.